Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C. And you're tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Judge Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation is at risk after accusation by Dr. Christine Ford. Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh is denying an allegation of sexual misconduct. Dr. Christine Ford alleges that Kavanaugh sexually assaulted her when he was 17 and she was 15. One summer night in the early 1980s, she said Kavanaugh pinned her down and attempted to remove her clothes, placing his hand over her mouth when she tried to scream. She claimed she was in fear for her life. The White House released a new statement from Kavanaugh calling it a completely false allegation. The federal judge said he has never done anything like what the accuser describes to her or to anyone. Deborah Katz, who is representing Ford, says her client is willing to testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Senate Democrats are calling for a delay in Kavanaugh's confirmation process. Kavanaugh noted that he is willing to talk with senators to refute the allegation from 36 years ago and to defend his integrity. Monster storm Mangkhut leaves a trail of death and destruction across Asia. As hurricane and now tropical depression Florence decimates the Carolinas and heads east, monster storm Mangkhut has ripped through parts of Southeast and East Asia, leaving a trail of death and destruction. Bodies were still being pulled out of mudslides and rubble on the main island of Luzon in the Philippines, which bore the brunt of the super typhoon over the weekend with winds of more than 143 miles per hour. You know, it's interesting how poorly the United States has managed these disasters with Florence and how many died in Puerto Rico and how long it has taken the U.S. government to respond to those in Puerto Rico fully. South Carolina officials faced criticism after they refused to evacuate 1,500 inmates from prisons in areas of the state being affected by Hurricane Florence that are in a mandatory evacuation zone. In other parts of South Carolina, evacuating was too costly for some in the path of Florence. For the poorest residents of the city of Myrtle Beach, the storm is a reminder of the city's economic and racial inequality. So the richest country in the world can't protect its poorest residents of color and its inmates any better than those affected by the T10 typhoon that hit Thailand and other countries in Asia. Russian defense minister rules out new operation in Idlib after Putin and Erdogan talk. According to Sputnik News, Russian President Vladimir Putin and his Turkish counterpart Recep Erdogan have met in Sochi, where they discussed the situation in Syria's Idlib province, one of the remaining pockets of insurgency in the Arab Republic. Following the talks between Putin and Erdogan, Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu announced that Russia would not conduct a military operation in Idlib. Quote, in the next few hours, we will coordinate all the issues set forth in this document with them, Damascus authorities, Shoigu, that's how you pronounce it, told reporters, showing the memorandum on Idlib settlement signed by him and his Turkish counterpart. The meeting comes a little over a week after the Russia-Turkey-Iran summit in Tehran, where the ceasefire guarantor states focused on the question of the Idlib de-escalation zone and ways to minimize risks for the civilian population related to the counterterrorism struggle. Earlier in the day, Putin stated that Moscow and Ankara would establish a demilitarized zone along the contact line between the armed opposition and Syrian troops, which would be controlled by Turkey and Russian military police. It will be interesting to see how the U.S. responds to this development. You're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Is Judge Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation at risk after accusations by Dr. Christine Ford? Supreme Court nominee Judge Brett Kavanaugh is denying an allegation of sexual misconduct. Dr. Ford alleges that Kavanaugh held her down, groped her, covered her mouth when she tried to scream when they were in high school in 1982, and she also claims that she was in fear for her life. What does this mean for the nomination going forward? Well, for insight, we turn to my first guests. First, she is the president and founder of Transformative Justice Coalition. She's internationally renowned for contributions on criminal justice issues, including the passage of the landmark Civil Rights Act of 1991 and the 2006 reauthorization of provisions of the Voting Rights Act, attorney Barbara Arnwine. Barbara, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you always for joining us. We're also joined by the Matthews Distinguished University Professor of Law, Northeastern University School of Law, and former dean of that program and author of With Passion, An Activist Lawyer's Life, attorney Michael Meltzner. Michael, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Having me, Wilmer.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us. So I see three elements here, and you all tell me what you think as we'll try to get through them all. I see this as a political issue. I see this as an issue of optics. And I see this as an issue of process. Barbara, let's start with you. Your thoughts, please.
Well, it's definitely Anita Hill Ray Doe. It is a reminder to our nation that we never did right by Anita Hill. We never set up a process whereby we really could, in a public appointment, a public, you know, confirmation battle, have a real discussion about sexual harassment, sexual misconduct. But here we have something worse, rape, you know, attempted rape. Here we have this horrible situation where not only did he, you know, push her into the room, close the door, put his hand over her mouth, he turned the music up so nobody could hear any protests or what was going on. Now, that's the allegation. And what people need to understand is that everything that went wrong with the Clarence Thomas hearing, when Anita Hill raised these issues during the confirmation battle for Clarence Thomas back in 1991 to the Supreme Court, that men folded, they caved. They didn't know quite how to answer the allegations. And some of the same defense lines that we heard back then, we're hearing again. Oh, it was a young, you know, he was young. Oh, how do you believe this woman? Why didn't she come forth earlier? Why haven't we heard about this before? What is her credibility? Why should we trust her? All of these same defenses we're hearing again, and this is what women hear all the time. And I think that the good news for Dr. Ford is that some things have changed. For example, you know, Anita Hill was out there by herself. Well, Dr. Ford now has over 200 women from her school who know her throughout the years to come forth and are saying we support her, that we have our, that this is a colleague who we know has credibility and is a person of good means and good character. We also saw the head of her school come forth, her high school, Holton Arms, come forth and say, you know, we believe that her allegations are credible and need to be investigated. None of that happened for Anita Hill. She was out there by herself, other than the, you know, the congresswomen who are demanding that this investigation proceed. I think we're in a little bit of a different era, but I do think that we're still seeing too much of the same inability to grapple wholesale, honestly, and with seriousness about these type of really outrageously harmful allegations mm-hmm. have that go to the heart of your character, because a Supreme Court justice can't just be someone who's only about their own image, protecting it at any cost. It's got to be someone who has real heart for justice. And we've seen with Clarence Thomas what happens when you get somebody on the bench who really has no heart for justice.
Professor Meltzner, your thoughts. Again, I see this political, optical, or optically, and there are process issues. Your thoughts.
Well, let's go back to your formulation. First, process. So there's going to be a public hearing where both of them are going to testify. But the shape of that hearing is totally unclear. When is it going to take place? And what kind of other witnesses are going to be available? Now, Barbara mentioned a number of people who've come forth. You know, in the Anita Hill situation, there were witnesses or who could testify to corroborate in various ways Anita's testimony. They were never called.
Exactly.
These people making statements to the press and they being part of the process. So while it's plain that the nomination is at risk and delayed, exactly how this is going to play out is still unclear. That's the process. As far as the optics are concerned, well, certainly Kavanaugh's at risk, but we really have the battle of the narratives. Just as we have over enormous number of issues in the last 2 years. And it's kind of interesting that the president has come out with his usual distraction strategy by just today authorizing the declassification of information that the intelligence community wants to keep private. We just don't know how this is going to shape out. As far as the politics are concerned, well, it's certainly, if one believes that women are going to determine the shape of the November election, well, then on the surface, at least, this is even worse news for the Republicans than they've been receiving. On the other hand, there are people who think that if certain Americans think that somehow or other Kavanaugh is getting a raw deal, or if Dr. Ford doesn't come through the way she seems to come through so far, because her statement to the Washington Post is full of incredible details, that might energize Republicans to come out and vote. So those are comments on the three dynamics that I think you correctly identify. I want to say one other thing, though, that I haven't heard anyone say, but which I really believe, and that is that regardless of how this comes out, and I'd have to say as a betting man that it's still 60-40, 70-30 in favor of Kavanaugh, regardless of how it comes out, there's a way in which this is a great comment and thing for democracy. Because what we have is a private individual who has upended the process that the most powerful people in the country have set in motion by her public statement and courage. And there are a lot of countries in the world where that could not happen.
I think that's a very accurate observation. In terms of, in terms of optics and politics, I think the two are very closely related in this regard. When we look at the senators that are in charge of the Judiciary Committee, they're, I think it's 7 or 8 older white men. And the optics of those men challenging Dr. Ford, and I can only imagine for as much as they will try at the beginning of the hearing, at some point is going to get contentious. And when those guys go after her,
white men on the Republican side,
right? On the Republican side, yes, yes, because there are Democratic females on the other side. I was speaking specifically to the Republican side. I think the optics of that is going to be, well, let me say, if it goes as contentious as I think it could go, that could be a very, very ugly afternoon for that Judiciary Committee, because I can only see the female Democrats siding with Dr. Ford, and that won't look good on MSNBC or any of the other networks that are carrying it. Barbara, your thoughts?
I watched.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Professor Meltzer. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I watched the statement that the president made to the press this afternoon. And as soon as it was over, the White House correspondents for two or three cable networks immediately said that the president was unusually disciplined and restrained. And I think what one's going to see is that the Republicans, if they start to question and interrogate Dr. Ford, are going to try and be that way. It's going to be interesting to see whether they can maintain that or whether they're going to go over to the kind of conduct that took place during Dr. Hill's testimony, and that came from both Republicans and Democrats, unfortunately. You know, you can kind of look at what's happening in a literary way as the revenge of Anita Hill, because as Barbara says, today it's a very different situation.
And Barbara, as you respond to that, and I'm glad you brought up Anita Hill, I think it's important for people to remember that it was Senator Joe Biden who refused to permit the public testimony from a number of witnesses who endorsed Ms. Hill's version of the events with Clarence Thomas. In fact, she said, "He did a disservice to me, a disservice more importantly to the public." She said that in a 2014 Huffington Post interview. She said, "I wish I had been able." Then he comes out later and says he wishes he, that being Biden, had been able to do more for Hill. He owes her an apology. But again, he was the one that based, in fact, he voted with the Republicans to vote the nomination out of committee. It was a 7-7 tie, and I think he voted with six Republicans.
11 Democrats voted for Clarence Thomas.
Wow.
And that is the dilemma, because what is, you know, this whole reality that we live in a country where our governance is artificial. We have, we have too few women in political power, disproportionately excluded from political power, frankly, because there's no reason why Congress, the House of Representatives, and the Senate should not be 50% women, as is our population. There are women capable, but our barriers and our male, you know, privilege, male dominance in our society has pushed women back. Well, I think that the good thing that will happen from this is that it's going to make people really question about the role of women. Lisa Murkowski, Susan Collins are going to be under more pressure than they've ever been, because already they were getting it from the reproductive rights community. But they're going to hear it super this time, because people are saying, well, what does a woman candidate mean? What is her real voice? What's her real representation? What's her real power? Who stands up in the breach for women when women are under attack? Because we know that the men, as we already have seen, will say, oh, well, it was just a youthful indiscretion.
It was locker room talk. And let me, we just have a couple minutes left, and so let me get Professor Meltzer in. I'm glad Barbara brought up Murkowski and Collins, because I, if if Dr. Ford comes through credibly, and to your point, as she has laid out incredible detail, and one of the details that I found for me very convincing was that she mentions one of Judge Kavanaugh's buddies. She puts one of his buddies in the room. Now, he says he was too drunk to remember anything, which to me also gives credibility to her story. Kavanaugh may be saying, I didn't do it because he was too drunk to remember. So, the optics of this woman sitting there telling this story, Murkowski and Collins are going to have a real heavy lift on this one, Professor Meltzner.
And this plays into the other issues that were just mentioned that led them to at least be questionable supporters. They probably were going to vote for him. But there are a host of other issues, Murkowski and her relationship with the Native
peoples in Alaska.
Yeah, and Collins and her comments about a woman's right to control her body and choose. So if the weight is on the scale is a little bit in favor of Dr. Ford, this may be the end of the game for Kavanaugh. And then there are, it's a long shot perhaps, but there are a couple of other Republicans who, Senator Flake and Corker, who might act in a certain way if the evidence looks bad for Kavanaugh. I was impressed too by the factual information that she came up with, and I don't think I think the narrative the Republicans are going to come up with is exactly as Barbara described it, but I just don't think it's going to work, and so the process is terribly important. How wide is the net going to be cast? Because in the end, it's the facts that will determine this. Who else was there? What did they say? Are they questioned? Are there people out there who can in some way corroborate the story?
You know, I think if Mitch McConnell were smart, and we need to end on this, he'd pull the plug on this one now. Sending Kavanaugh into battle on this one, I think he's cannon fodder.
No, they're going to listen. They're going to let him be confirmed. They're going to use their raw power, and they're going to lose ultimately because the optics of his being on that court will be forever damning to their party.
Wow.
Hasn't hurt Clarence Thomas.
And he damn sure has hurt us. So let me say to the both of you, thank you so much, Attorney Barbara Arnwine, Professor Michael Meltzner. Thank you both for coming on the Critical Hour. Greatly, greatly appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Wilmer. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm sure there'll be more of this to discuss a little bit later. Thank you both. All right, folks, you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Jason Van Dyke, the Chicago police officer charged with murder in the fatal shooting of Laquan McDonald, went on trial today. In a city where police officers have been involved in dozens of controversial shootings without facing charges, the case against Officer Van Dyke has taken an added significance. Relations between the police and residents, especially residents of color, has been long troubled, and some people see the trial as a rare test of whether an officer can ever be held accountable for taking a life. For insight into this, it's important to realize a police officer has not been convicted or even charged, I believe, with murder in Chicago since 1970. For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. She is a ceasefire violence interrupter in Englewood, Illinois. She works with at-risk youth to put an end to gang violence. She is Dr. Amina Matthews. Dr. Matthews, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you for having me, and hello, family. And yes, we are at a critical hour. How are you?
I am great. Thank you so much for giving us time this evening. Before we get into our discussion about Jason Van Dyke, explain to the audience what you do as a ceasefire violence interrupter, because you are truly on the front line of this issue.
Well, thank you so much. I am no longer, the organization Ceasefire is no longer up and running.
Oh, okay.
Changed the name to Cure Violence. And I work with the YMCA YSVP program, Youth Safety Violence Prevention. And I am dealing with at-risk youth and their family, trauma-informed care, to make sure that violence is not transmitted from one person to another like a disease.
Understood. Thank you. Thank you. So let's talk about what's going on in Chicago, how the community is really perceiving this case against Officer Van Dyke. How is this playing out in the neighborhood?
You know, one thing I want people to understand is that he has pled guilty, right? He has pled guilty. He has a first-degree murder charge, and he's still coming home to the bench a year later. So what they did was they picked the witnesses and advocates, as well as community stakeholders, the media. They were in that process of the first five and the second five. So how we're looking at this is like, why is the process taking so long? Why are you, one of the elderly ladies that's on the juror made it perfectly clear that she was friends with the judge, as well as the state's attorneys and their families. And when they were questioning her, they asked, well, what do you think about? And she said, well, you know, he was just doing his job. Now, other jurors was looking at Van Dyke and was like, you know what? Hey, I know what's going on, and he's guilty. And they kicked them out. But they kept this lady that is really cool with the judge, really cool with the attorneys, state's attorneys, so cool with, you know,
We're having some difficulty with your phone.
Can you
hear me? Yeah, we can hear you. Go ahead.
So now what they're trying to do was you moved, because they said that, you know, it's intimidating to the jurors, it's intimidating to Van Dyke's family. You know, I understand when force of your armed weapon as a police officer needs to be used. But on a 17-year-old young man that had one of those little, you know, those little 2-inch little knives that have the corkscrew and
yes,
you know, the little utility set that
a Swiss Army knife.
A Swiss Army knife, exactly. But all of that was broken up in there. He unloaded 16 bullets to that young man, and they had to stop him. They had to pull his arm back because he was going for his clip to load again. He chased this young man before he shot him down, what they're not showing, but you can go and get those videos. He chased them through the yard of Burger King. You know how Burger King has
yes,
drive-through?
And yes, the playground and whatnot.
Have the front. They have a front.
Right.
And he chased them through the front of the Burger King. And then he lynched him with those bullets 16 times. And to reload.
And continued to fire when he was down.
Continued as he, from the first hit, he hit him and it was I don't want to say exact hit, but it was a direct hit to an artery. He needed not to do anymore. So now, so here's the debilitating part of it for our community. They have one African-American on the juror. They have an Asian, Hispanic, and all the rest other. So they did not go for a bench trial. They went for the jury trial. So now we do have community activists that it hurts me and it breaks my heart to the point, yes, I want it to be a peaceful, I want it to be a peaceful ruling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want it to be just. We as a community want it to be just because it is unacceptable. We're reverting back into the slavery times that when someone is, you know, leaving the plantation, you gun them down, you cut their feet off, you cut their hands off, you mm-hmm. eyes out. That's
right.
Unacceptable. So now there's people that saddens me that is working. You know, our mayor decided that he was not going to run for another term.
That was my next question. So where is the mayor on this?
So the mayor decided that he's not going to run again. There's community activists that's been on this, you know, on this movement for justice for Laquan for a while now.
Mm-hmm.
That is, you know, Rahm is paying them to make sure that the city is not torn up, that it's a peaceful demonstration, that we're going to be standing out, holding hands, kumbaya, if Van Dyke gets acquitted.
Any idea when the trial is supposed to wrap up?
Opening statements was today.
Right.
So now, you know, they're saying sometime 2019.
Whoa.
How much longer do we need?
And he pled guilty. He
admitted guilt. Mm-hmm.
Wow. This is kind of confusing. This is kind of confusing.
No, sir. This goes back to, if we go through the archives and we look at how J. Edgar Hoover, how they put that man in position to make sure that you control the organized crime,
mm-hmm.
right? It started off with, you know, helping somebody get their baby back that ended up not right. But ever since that dude has been in play and they put policies in place, crack versus cocaine, DCFS in our, you know, families' businesses, and husbands and fathers away from their
families, right?
Children.
For housing now, issues, right?
Mass incarceration for women is out of control. That is a government decision to make that. That this policy, what's going on with Laquan, has been in place for many of years.
Mm-hmm.
We, you know, if we do our, if you look, just if you just Google it.
Right, right. So what is the chatter? And we just have about a minute and a half before we got to wrap this up. I just want to just go back to when you're waiting for the bus, when you're standing in the grocery store line to check out. What are people talking about?
We just hope that it's not another, versus, you know, the slave mentality that this man, this murderer, gets away with shooting a 17-year-old mentally disabled, disturbed young man.
That's another very important point to make about this is that Laquan was challenged, and none of that was brought into effect as he was being summarily executed by Van Dyke.
And after that, if you follow what's going on here, after that, I mentioned the last time that we spoke about an innocent bystander named Betty Jones in Antonio.
Yes.
A Spanish officer shot him from the sidewalk. They knew that he was, the 911 was like, my son is not taking his medicine. I need some help. Instead of sending an ambulance.
Right.
Mexican brother came and shot that house up, killing him and an innocent bystander. Eddie Johnson, real quick, after it was founded that it was just unjustifiable.
Mm-hmm.
Eddie Johnson said that it was justifiable under the policies that was in place then. I want to see those policies. Are they under John Burgess?
I got to stop you there. I'm up against the break. As always, Dr. Amina Matthews, thank you for your work. I'll remember next time that you're with the YMCA. I'll be sure to get that straight. And I look forward to having you back on the Critical Hour.
No, sir. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. And I got to give a big shout out and much love and thanks to the Facebook family. Thank you all so much for your support as we, uh, as we, uh, in, continue on the Critical Hour. I greatly, greatly appreciate it. Tell your friends this is where they need to come from 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern when they want to find out what's going on in the Critical Hour. You are listening. You've been listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. So, in the attempt to first punish and then pressure the Palestinians to accept the so-called peace plan, the U.S. delivers $3.3 billion in military aid to Israel, while the U.S. cuts all funding for the Palestinian humanitarian relief through UNRWA. The U.S. and India signed a breakthrough security agreement on September 6th, cementing relations between the pair and unlocking sales of high-tech American weaponry worth billions of dollars to the world's top arms importer. Back in March, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman came to the White House, and President Trump was all praise for the prince and mentioned that the kingdom purchased planes, missiles, and frigates from U.S. companies worth $12.5 billion. What do all these arms sales really translate into in the context of American foreign policy? For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He holds the Moores Chair in the Department of African American History at the University of Houston. He's one of the most prolific writers of our time, Dr. Gerald Horn. Welcome back to the Critical Hour.
For inviting me.
Gerald, my son is 16 years old and has never known peace in his lifetime. Is my observation a valid one about all of this U.S. billions and billions of dollars of weapon sales? Is this a valid concern?
It is absolutely a valid concern. Not only has that thought occurred to yourself, but recall that in his now famous farewell address to the nation, circa 1961, U.S. President Dwight David Eisenhower, then signing off, raised grave concerns about what he called the military-industrial complex in the United States and its ability to shape foreign policy. I think that Mr. Eisenhower's worst nightmares have become reality. And in fact, you see a situation where, in some sense, the tail is wagging the dog. That is to say, arms sales are helping to shape U.S. foreign policy. For example, if you look at those arms sales to Saudi Arabia, for example, one of the reasons why relations are so close between Saudi Arabia and the United States, besides oil, and by the way, the United States is about to surpass Saudi Arabia as an oil-producing nation, is because Saudis spend so many dollars buying U.S. armed purchases, which then lines the pockets of the military-industrial complex. It lines the pockets of investors in corporations like Lockheed Martin, for example, and therefore it helps to ensure that this most repressive regime stays on the good side of Uncle Sam. These arms sales are also warping U.S. foreign policy. You mentioned the arms sales to India, for example. One of the bones of contention now between New Delhi and Washington is not only the fact that India intends to keep buying oil from Iran, which will be facing tightened U.S. sanctions within weeks, but also because Washington objects to the fact that India continues to buy arms from Russia, which has been a longtime comrade of India, going back to India's independence in August 1947. So you are correct to raise grave and searching concerns about the impact of arms sales on the structure and shaping of U.S. foreign policy.
You know, one of the things I think it's overlooked when people discuss Eisenhower's farewell address and his reference to the military-industrial complex is that at that point in American history, there had not been an established arms manufacturing element within our economy. During World War I and World War II, domestic production had to be retooled in order to facilitate the arms, what we now know as the arms industry. And so that had an incredible positive impact on the economy. But now what I think we find is the economy is booming and to a great degree because of these particular areas of the military industrial complex, but that doesn't really translate across the board in terms of everybody being able to participate and enjoy the wealth.
Well, it's actually worse than that grim scenario that you just sketched. For example, arms sales, needless to say, help to grease the skids and lubricate the path for war itself. In fact, if you read closely and carefully the new Bob Woodward book, Fear, Trump and the White House, you walk away with the impression that one of the bones of contention between General Mattis, the head of the Pentagon, Secretary of Defense, and his ostensible superior, President Bush, President Trump, is that Mr. Mattis is not as enthusiastic about going to war as is Mr. Trump. Apparently, Mr. Trump recognizes that war is not necessarily bad for the bottom line of the military-industrial complex. And apparently, Mr. Mattis is more concerned about disabled soldiers, sailors, and Marines. Keep in mind as well that these arms sales, in many ways, are de facto bribes, if not actual bribes, to the chief investors in the military-industrial complex, who in turn then supply campaign donations to politicians. Recall that the late Senator Henry Jackson of the state of Washington was known as the senator from Boeing, Boeing being also a major constituent element of the military-industrial complex, and he represented Boeing's interests quite ably, I should say, perhaps even more so than the people of the state of Washington.
I think a perfect, very recent example of how the military interest is impacting the foreign policy is what we're seeing play out right before our eyes as it relates to the United States, North Korea, and South Korea. North Korea has been asking for a very long time for there to be a final resolution of the what we know as the Korean War. He wants a treaty. And South Korea is very interested in working towards that end. But the United States is balking at the move because once a treaty gets signed, bringing a actual end to the Korean War, then the next question is, so then why do we need all these troops in South Korea?
Well, staying in that part of the world, it's also quite striking to note all of these alarmist stories of late in the U.S. press about China building up its Navy. Obviously, that's a signal to the U.S. military-industrial complex to start building more battleships, more destroyers, more aircraft carriers. Likewise, it's interesting to note that there is a further downside to these arms sales. You mentioned arms sales to Israel, for example. It has not been featured in the U.S. press, although it's known quite widely and notoriously outside of the United States press, that Israel has become closer to China, and in fact has been accused credibly of leaking advanced U.S. military technology to Beijing, which is something that I'm sure is of interest and concern in the Pentagon as we speak.
And I'm glad you brought up China, because one of the reasons that the United States has invested so much time and energy into its relationship with India and selling arms to India is trying to be a hedge against the growth of China. But as China has been expanding its military, what China has really been doing is expanding its economy. And I would think that if the United States spent more time on the economic side of the equation instead on what I would call the very simplistic military side of the equation, the entire world would be in a much better and safer place.
Well, you know, I have roots in Mississippi, and as my Mississippi-born mother used to say, what you said makes too much good sense. And given the environment that we now have to endure in the United States, that virtually ensures that your good sense will not be followed up on or executed. But the story gets worse, because one of the bones of contention in terms of the deterioration of relationship between Washington and Ankara, Washington and Turkey.
That's my next move. Go ahead. That's my next point. Go ahead.
Is the fact that Washington is upset because Turkey is being accused of buying advanced weaponry from Russia. And Washington feels that Turkey should be a captive market for U.S. arms sales. However, it seems to me it makes sense for Turkey to buy this kind of weaponry from Russia, not least because of the fact that Washington has been credibly accused of helping to foment a coup against President Erdogan in Turkey in the summer of 2016, but also because of the conflict in Syria, in Idlib province, that features Turkey on the one side and Russia along with Iran on the other. It makes good sense for Ankara to try to sidle up to Moscow and stay on Moscow's good side, not least by making purchases from Russia. But once again, you see arms sales helping to shape the contours of U.S. foreign policy, which can only end in tears.
I'm glad you brought that up. I'm going to ask a question you may or may not know the answer. And if you don't, this will probably be the first question I've ever asked you that you didn't know the answer to. But on the arms side, what also is important to understand is that Turkey's aircraft industry is very, very important to the development of the U.S. F-35 Joint Strike Fighter jet. And that I think that the United States sees a conflict in Turkey helping to develop or provide parts for the F-35 while also buying the S-400 missile defense system from Russia, because I think the S-400 was primarily designed to counter the F-35 fighter jet.
Well, you know, I detect a pattern here. I mean, veering in another direction, it's quite striking that the multi-billionaire Sackler family has been accused credibly of helping to foment this opioid epidemic by selling these painkillers, such as OxyContin, in the United States of America. Now they develop an antidote to painkillers that now will be selling in the billions as well. So Turkey might have read the stories about the Sacklers and decided to follow up.
So my question now is, and this story just broke either late yesterday or today, that leading up to this weekend, there had been an awful lot of discussion about Idlib, and I'm bringing this up because you mentioned Idlib, that there's been an awful lot of discussion about Idlib, about whether or not chemical weapons were being used and whether or not the United States was claiming a false flag operation with these chemical weapons. Nikki Haley's at the UN threatening if chemical weapons are used, the United States coming in. Now we find out that President Putin and Erdogan of Turkey have agreed that Russia will not militarily intervene in Idlib, that they will create a no-fly zone, but a demilitarized zone, and that they're going to try to find a peaceful way to disarm the combatants and to strike a deal. And I'm just wondering what brought this about. Is it that Erdogan and Putin are really smarter than Donald Trump and saying, you know what, a conflict right here doesn't work well for anybody?
Well, I think President Erdogan is under a lot of pressure. Obviously, his relationship with his ostensible NATO ally in Washington has deteriorated. The United States has slapped sanctions on Turkey, helping to drive the Turkish lira into the ditch, causing enormous economic pain in Turkey itself. And so it makes good sense for Mr. Erdogan to try to cut a deal, not only with Russia, but with Iran. And speaking of Iran, I think that the impending tightening sanctions of Iran is going to be leading the United States, if not the planet itself, to the brink of destruction or catastrophe minimally. And I say that in part because there's a very disturbing op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal this morning that's basically threatening former Secretary of State John Kerry with prosecution under the Logan Act because he's been having informal talks with his former Iranian counterparts about the nuclear deal, which he helped negotiate. When there's talk in a major newspaper about a prosecution of a former U.S. Secretary of State because of friendly conversations with an Iranian, you know that we're headed towards disaster.
And that, to me, once again, Gerald, you take me right where I need to go. That right there takes me to the point of war versus peace, because Kerry is trying to defuse the problem in the Middle East. Signing a peace treaty with North Korea between North and South Korea would defuse the tensions in the region. Americans need to really start understanding that the United States, whether it's the assassination of Gaddafi and the resulting hostilities in that region, whether it is the invasion of Iraq and what's happening as a result of all of that, that these are intentional, pot-stirring, wasp-nest-swatting, crazy warmongers who understand, as Gil Scott-Heron said, ask them what they're fighting for, and they'll never mention the economics of war.
Well, what's even more concerning than opening the gates of hell, which is what a conflict with Iran would surely bring, it's once again returning to the Woodward book, Fear, Trump in the White House. The picture he paints is rather contradictory in a sense when it comes to Iran. On the one hand, he suggests that Secretary of Defense Mattis was dismissed by Obama because of his hawkish views on Iran, that Mattis has a score to settle with Iran, going back to his accusation that Iran was involved in the blowing up of a Marine barracks in Beirut some decades ago. But at the same time, it appears from the overall picture that Mattis is a restraining factor on Trump with regard to going to war with Iran. And if that's the case, it seems that Mr. Trump is to the right of the man known as Mad Dog Mattis when it comes to stirring up a conflict with Iran, which means that the situation is actually worse than it looks.
Is it too simplistic to say that during the Obama administration, Mad Dog Mattis was merely trying to pick a fight with Iran, where he now is constraining on the Trump side because Trump wants to basically blow up the whole damn planet? I mean, is that too simplistic?
No, I don't think it's simplistic at all. And perhaps Mr. Mattis has learned a very difficult lesson, which is that his seeking to push the Obama administration to the right, which is the message from the Woodward book, has eventuated and he has gotten what he apparently wished for and now wants to dial it back. But the question is it too late to dial it back?
Especially when you have Pompeo, but more importantly, you have who's the defense, the security advisor with the
Bolton.
Now that you've got Bolton in Trump's ear, that's the guy that's singing the tune that Trump really wants to dance to.
Well, I'm afraid you're correct. And even more disturbing in that context is Mr. Bolton's speech from a few days ago threatening the judges on the International Criminal Court of The Hague. Not only is it rather strange because the United States is not signatory to their treaty and already there's a law in effect that threatens doom for the ICC if the ICC goes after U.S. personnel, but it's also disturbing from the point of view of the ICC because they've been dancing to the tune of Washington. One would think that the only war criminals that they're after are those who are allegedly situated in Africa. He has not talked about going after Tony Blair, the former prime minister of Great Britain, for his transgressions concerning the attack on Iran in 2003, not to mention U.S. President George W. Bush. But in any case, when Bolton gave that speech, the message I carried away is that the United States has in mind further war crimes, particularly perhaps targeting Iran, and that he is now giving cover to the Pentagon in case the Pentagon wants to move in that dangerously destructive direction.
I need to stop you right there. Dr. Gerald Horn, as always, sir, thank you for your time. Thank you for your insight. Looking forward to getting you back on the Critical Hour.
Thank you for inviting me.
You've been listening to the Critical Hour. It's another day. It's another Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you all for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.